So Mike Krebs is an indigenous activist of Blackfoot, Cree, and European descent. Based in Vancouver, he has previously been active in Palestine solidarity organizing. And I'm going to add a little editorial. You'll probably be upset at me later, but I wanted to acknowledge that Mike has been a longtime supporter of Kwaya and all of its different iterations, since the days that folks were marching in the parade and in the interim as well. And he got many of us who are in Kwaya currently actually involved in different ways in Palestine solidarity work. And for me, he was a particular inspiration in terms of doing that. So Mike will be talking about a number of things, including looking at settler colonialism in Canada and in Palestine. So over to Mike.
Okay, can people hear me? Okay, yes, thanks everybody. Of course, just wanted to start to acknowledge that we're on unceded indigenous lands of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam. I had some printing problems, so it's kind of just as awkward for me as it might be to watch for me to read from a computer screen, but it will have to do. I'm really honored to be part of this forum, and as I mentioned, I was involved with I guess it's been two Kwaya Vancouver Pride contingents, as an ally, as part of my capacity as being here today. I'm really excited with the recent work that Kwaya Vancouver's been doing, and happy that this forum has come together. I'm hoping that my talk today will provide some context concerning the implications of doing Palestine solidarity work from within Canada, which is for Israel basically a fellow settler society. I want to discuss the similarities between Canada's treatment of Indigenous people and Israel's policies of apartheid and occupation towards Palestinian people. I want to, in that, include the ways that settler colonialism in Canada has been and continues to be a very gendered process. If I have time, which I probably won't, I wanted to discuss a little bit redwashing, which is somewhat similar to pinkwashing, but I think it's important to look at, and it's certain ways it's really similar and it's instructive to understanding pinkwashing. For anyone who's carrying out campaigns of boycott, divestment, sanctions, or similar Palestine solidarity work in Canada, it's taking place in what is one of the most pro-Israeli countries in the world. This support from Canada for the state of Israel, it predates Israel's existence, includes support for the UN partition plan of Palestine in 1947 by key Canadian politicians. But of course, in recent years, that support has gotten stronger. It's a common discussion now where Canada competes with the U.S. to be, one of the most pro-Israeli countries in the world. Given the U.S.'s very special, close, and long-standing relationship with Israel, and its support of billions of dollars in military and economic aid, it says a lot in terms of Canada's support. In terms of how the Canadian government discusses this relationship, just briefly from the Department of Foreign Affairs website, Canada and Israel have strong, multidimensional bilateral relations marked by close political, economic, social, and cultural ties. Support for Israel, especially its right to live in peace and security with its neighbors, has been at the core of Canada's Middle East policy since 1948. And just regularly, the Canadian government issues statements to sort of reaffirm this. There's an April 13th press release from the Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister titled, "Canada Reaffirms Its Special Relationship with Israel." And then there they state, "Following a warm and constructive meeting today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Canadian Foreign Minister John Baird reaffirmed a close and special relationship that underpins a bilateral relationship between our two countries." And this support by the Canadian government for Israel manifests itself in a number of ways. One of the major ways is on the international stage. And this includes the defense of Israel against any scrutiny or culpability for the war crimes and human rights violations that it commits against Palestinians. This includes defending Israel's actions in the 2006 invasion of Lebanon. And in 2009, on the UN Human Rights Council had a resolution condemning Israel's actions during Operation Cast Lead. Canada was the only country to vote against that resolution on the Human Rights Council. This also includes Canada time and time again being one of the few countries that will regularly vote with Israel on resolutions in the UN General Assembly, including most recently in September 2012, Canada joined Israel, the US, Czech Republic, Panama, and a handful of other countries voting against a General Assembly resolution granting Palestinians non-member observer state status, the final tally being 138 in favor and 9 against. Similarly, Canada has a close relationship with Israel in terms of trade. It's the first free trade agreement outside of North America with Israel in 1997, and trade between Canada and Israel has tripled since then. But what I want to discuss is what I understand is sort of why this relationship exists between Canada and Israel. Sometimes it's related to the influence of Christian Zionism within the conservative government, and the ways that Israel represents and advances Canadian interests in the Middle East. But I don't think it can be reduced to these things. For me, one of the major factors is the fact that both Canada and Israel are colonial settler states with similar histories, similar nature, unless they both have similar interests, especially in the realm of international politics. Both Canada and Israel were founded on the colonization, theft, displacement, and dispossession, and as a result, the impoverishment of the indigenous people of those lands. And in both cases, these are struggles that continue today, along with continued processes of settler colonialism. So what do I mean by settler colonialism? Give one often used definition from David Lloyd and Laura Pulido, where they define settler colonialism as the practice of conquering land and then populating it with the victorious people, the settlers. Such a population shift may be triggered by the need for space for an expanding population, or may be prompted by the need to assert economic and political control in the new territory. Regardless, it results in the dispossession and often the extermination of large parts of the native populations, and the subsequent cultural, economic, and political subordination of the remainder. Is there any more water? So I just wanted to I'll go into just some of the major processes of Canada and Israel to outline the similarities between the two settler colonial projects. The major and more obvious one would be the types of spatial tactics that both Canada and Israel have used in their colonial projects. Canada, the main part of this is the reserve system, which was and remains a policy of containment. And basically a binary fragmentation of the traditional territories of indigenous peoples into reserve lands for Indians and everything else for the settlers. These similar tactics have manifested as well in Israel, or been used by Israel, since the 1948 Nakba, when the State of Israel was declared. And it involves a process of further containing Palestinians and acquiring the territories in stages. This is the West Bank and Gaza, and the further fragmentation of those lands, the division of West Bank into several zones. This also includes the systems of permits, checkpoints, and the apartheid wall, restricting and regulating the movement of Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, along with the near Hamitic siege of Gaza as the most extreme expression of control over movement to and from and within the occupied territories. And in both situations with Canada and Israel, tied to this fragmentation of the territories are systems that regulate identity, which dictate the kind of land and residency rights that are to be available to Indigenous people based on how they've been categorized by the Canadian and Israeli governments. In Canada, this is through the Indian Act, in terms of definitions of who is Indian or not, or status versus non-status, Métis, as well as the ways in which status may be lost. And similarly, there's been the fragmentation of Palestinian identity, or at least in terms of the classification systems defined and recognized by Israel. We have Palestinians living within the 48 borders. We have different residency cards for Palestinians who are in Jerusalem. And then, of course, there's the stateless Palestinians of the diaspora, or Palestinians who are holding citizenship from other states. There's a lot of other examples I could go into, but I want to focus a bit on the regulation of identity, because it overlaps really in terms of the politics of gender and sexuality of Canadian settler colonialism. So for this, I'm going to focus on Canadian settler colonialism. Sorry, I just lost my... But Canadian settler colonialism has been a very gendered process across Turtle Island. And it's in one way, in that the whole process of settler colonialism itself embodies very gendered logics, patriarchal relationships of mastery and systems of hierarchy, that of the settler society over indigenous societies. The Cherokee scholar Andrea Smith discusses this in many of her works, where she argues that the connection between the colonization of Native people's bodies, particularly Native women's bodies, and Native lands is not simply metaphorical, but there's a connection between patriarchy's disregard for nature, women, and Indigenous peoples. But this gendered component of settler colonialism also has a social component, in terms of the institution of control and genocide against Indigenous people through gendered systems of violence. One example of this is the undermining of traditional Indigenous gender relationships. The European settlers who came here encountered a variety of gender relations, and in some cases a variety of gender identities, which were for the most part more egalitarian and more fluid than that which was allowed for within the patriarchal gender relations they brought with them. And these were relationships that had to be undermined as a means by which to weaken Indigenous societies and make dispossession easier. Two, as I discussed, there was the regulation of identity. This, of course, through the Indian Act, took place along very explicitly and blatantly gendered lines, including different standards for retaining status that were applied to Indigenous women versus Indigenous men. And this resulted in vast numbers of Indigenous women and their descendants losing not only their status as Indigenous people, but their ability to remain in their communities on reserve. So I think there's a way that there's the violence of colonialism that's inflicted on gender societies in a sort of broader sense that impacts entire communities regardless of their gender. But there's also the more specifically gendered components that then extend to affect the entire Indigenous communities. And I'm a product of that as a descendant of women who've lost their status as a result of Indian Act policies. It wasn't until 2010 with the changes through C3 that I was even technically eligible to apply to be recognized as status, which I've chosen not to do. And then finally, Canadian settler colonialism is a very gendered process in terms of the dehumanization and the violence that occurs and continues to occur against Indigenous women, including the cases of the more than 580 missing or murdered Indigenous women in the last 20 years. So I think in discussing this project of Canadian settler colonialism and making just some of the ways the comparisons with Israeli settler colonialism, it's important because it's crucial to understand why Canada supports Israel in the way that it does. In part, there's the similar nature of the two countries as settler states. It creates a solid foundation for this ideological affinity, where from the Canadian state's perspective, there's nothing particularly problematic or controversial that a predominantly European population would set up a state on the lands of a racialized people, displace those people, and settle the land. But also, I think Canada has its own interest in ensuring that Israel maintains immunity at the international level. I discussed some of the ways where Israel is increasingly coming under scrutiny on the international stage for human rights violations, policies of apartheid. But Canada, especially in recent years, has also come under scrutiny from some of the same bodies. This is from an April 29th press release that was jointly issued from Amnesty International, Native Women's Association of Canada, Union of BC Indian Chiefs, and several others. The press release states, many of Canada's closest diplomatic allies and trading partners are urging the federal government to do more to address the serious human rights issues facing First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. On Friday, Canada's human rights record was examined in a peer review process under the United Nations Human Rights Council. The vast majority of state comments related to persistent human rights violations experienced by Indigenous peoples in Canada. These include violation of land rights, inequalities in education, health, drinking water and sanitation, food insecurity, control over lands and resources, and racial discrimination. And more than 20 states raised specific concerns about the high levels of violence against Indigenous women in Canada. There's this, and there's ongoing. It's kind of a background issue, but at the international level, but there is a whole still going on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in regards to the residential school, and a lot of the discussion around whether or not this could be classified as an act of genocide. And it points to the ways that since the beginning, the Canadian government's definition of genocide has been rewritten within its own rules versus the international definition, so that the act of the residential schools wouldn't fall under its own definition of genocide. So I think these things are important because in terms of this discussion, because when Canada is defending Israel, blocking investigations and keeping it and preventing it from being accountable at an international level, it helps keep the UN and its various institutions weak and unable to properly uphold standards or prosecute violations of international law by Israel or Canada. I have time to talk about redwashing, which is not very well defined compared to pinkwashing. There's been no conferences around it or anything like that. And it's pretty, I think it's in a lot of ways, it's very particular to Canada. But
it's happening in the US too.
There's a little bit, yeah. Of course, it's, as I said, similar to pinkwashing. I think both of these types of propaganda, they grow out of Israel's need to try and redefine its message and its image internationally. And though these shifts in Israel's propaganda messaging abroad can make things difficult for the purposes of conducting solidarity work, it's also a reflection of the strength of that solidarity work, which is, of course, itself a reflection of the strength of the continued steadfastness of the Palestinian people in their resistance. If I would define it, redwashing is the use or misuse of Indigenous people and concepts of indigeneity for forwarding Israel advocacy in Canada and elsewhere. And I think this is basically taking advantage of the gains that Indigenous people have from struggle and the moral legitimacy of Indigenous struggle. Taking advantage of that. And it's something that's it's manifesting both inside Indigenous communities and outside. Inside Indigenous communities, a lot of this stemmed from, I guess it was going back over 10 years ago, it was comments made by David Ahenikew, and it was a former Grand Chief of the Saskatchewan Federation of First Nations, Indian Nations, FSIN, sorry. He made some really repugnant anti-Semitic comments. The Zionist lobby in Canada really took advantage of this as an inroads to try and get support from at least certain segments of like the First Nations leadership for Israel. This included a 2006 delegation by then Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Phil Fontaine. And it's manifested in other ways internally. It's often sold more as like cultural exchanges and sort of very, very plain on a really vague shift from talking about cultural exchanges where Jewish culture is inherently related to Israel as a state body. It's a very troubling thing to see, like the, in some ways how, like to watch this in terms of, just how much confusion it can create in terms of like the identification of Indigenous people with the settler society as opposed to with the Palestinians. But it does also come with a certain type of politics it can only be embodied within a particular politics of First Nations in Canada as well. Thank you. There's like the I think sorry what I'm trying to say is that is that luckily the sort of redwashing it doesn't have a lot of influence within Indigenous communities. I don't think it's only a particular wing of like First Nations leadership that'd be susceptible to this, because it falls in a lot of models of recognition and a sort of apolitical reconciliation sort of politics. If you take that out of the equation, you know, to try and relate the Indigenous experience here with that of the State of Israel, it just makes no sense whatsoever. It's completely backwards. But as we'll talk about in terms of pinkwashing, it's, you know, that's how propaganda works. I'll just wrap up quickly. But clearly, I think that it's essential for any successful Palestinian solidarity work in Canada. The colonial nature of Canada and the settler colonial nature of Canada needs to be recognized. I think for Canadians working to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, it must never be forgotten that Indigenous people here are struggling every day to survive the numerous ways in which Canadian settler colonialism and apartheid has damaged and continues to damage the original people whose land Canada was built on. I think in the wake of the I Don't Know More, this is something that's not very difficult to see, but this has been a resistance and a struggle of survival that's gone on for centuries. And I think mounting effective solidarity work for Palestinians can assist Canadians in coming to terms with what it means to be part of a settler society. And the ramifications of that for both Indigenous people and settlers are something that can only make the ability to support the Palestinian struggle against Israeli settler colonialism stronger. Thank you.